This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies are Beauty and the Beast, T2 Trainspotting, The Belko Experiment, and Atomica. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup with a spotlight on Allied, which I wasn't actually able to cover last November when it came out. But first, before we get into all of that, if you want to get a hold of me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is kind of interesting because it upset some people, but other people seem kind of excited about it. And it's the fact that they're moving ahead with a remake of The Matrix, or rather, they're going to be redoing The Matrix series. And that begs a question of, should it be done? Well, here's the thing. You got to realize that in 2 years, we're 20 years out from The Matrix. I think people don't realize it's that old of a movie because it was that ahead of its time. Back in 1999, when that thing came out, it blew people's minds and it pioneered a whole series of digital effects and other special effects like virtual cameras and some of the Wu-Ping fighting that you've seen before, but it really kind of took it to an even higher level with sort of like wire work. And even now you watch The Matrix, it does not feel like a 20-year-old movie or almost 20-year-old movie. So I think what that means is it shows how ahead of their time the Wachowskis were when they made this film. Now, that begs a question, could you or should you even remake The Matrix? I'm okay with it. It also seems that in these very early stages, they're looking at working in the world rather than just reshooting the same story of Neo. And one of the people that they're looking at to play the lead is Michael B. Jordan, who was, of course, in Creed and the Fantastic Four reboot. But one of the things that I think is interesting about it is some of the word has come out that they're thinking of using a writer's room style. And I have a friend who writes for TV coverage, does a lot of TV coverage. And he, of course, champions this because he's basically said, hey, look, here you've got a setup in a writer's room for a television show is different than just handing a script to one or two or just a handful team. Usually it's not a huge group effort to write a script for a movie unless if a lot of names are on it, it's just gone through a bunch of iterations. Now, some movies, like I think it was Blazing Saddles, has something like 8 writers on it. And that's because they did it as sort of this collective comedy group, but they couldn't put any more than 8 people's names on that script. And that's a WGA thing. Whereas a writer's room in a TV series, they knock around ideas and people work on different things and you have a showrunner who keeps that message on point. And that actually might help with this kind of series. You want to do a series where you can expand it. Everyone's trying to be like Marvel now. Marvel Studios kind of pioneered this. And they do kind of use a writing room model where they got Kevin Feige in charge of everything. Now, he doesn't write any of the scripts, but he focuses on the vision. And sometimes that ends up having conflicts with people. And there are conflicts with Marvel and Joss Whedon on the second Avengers movies. There was also conflicts with Edgar Wright when he was developing Ant-Man. So there are some downfalls to it, but it does keep a vision heading in the right direction. And what you end up with is, with sort of that group effort, you would end up with something that's less of a scorched earth path that tends to happen when you get an egomaniacal director involved. And you see this with any time a director is handed a movie, they want to give their own spin on it. You saw that actually happen with Zack Snyder when he did Man of Steel. He wanted to do his own spin on it. And you really see it in the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight movies. Now, I know people that that's the sacred cow. You're not allowed to complain about those movies. But when you look at those films, they divert completely from a DC extended universe And it's a very finite series. It has those three movies. It kills everything at the end of the movie. And I know that Warner Brothers has been struggling with the Justice League and what to do with their characters, that maybe this model is good to put into place for something like The Matrix early on, rather than trying to do a hurry-up offense while you're on the field, which is what they're doing with the DC Cinematic Universe. Hopefully this will help stop some of these conflicting visions you get from different directors. I'm kind of looking forward to it. I'm curious to see what they do, especially if the Wachowskis kind of give their blessing on the whole thing. The next piece of news I want to hit on is another thing that comes kind of from the DC Cinematic Universe, because it involves Ben Affleck. He apparently came out and made a statement that he was going through alcohol rehab. And people have been making jokes about it. And I'm like, come on, people. Good for him for getting off the sauce. If you got a problem with it and you're overcoming it, that's wonderful. That's great. You're a father, you're a husband. And this shows the stress level that may have been hitting him in terms of writing, directing, and starring in a movie, which is what he did with Live by Night. And this may have played into the decisions to not direct the Batman movie. But, you know, whatever it is, I wish Ben Affleck the best. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I don't like to redo trailers. If we had a trailer already for a movie, I don't throw the second trailer out or even the third trailer out. But I'm going to do that here because I've been kind of curiously watching the development of Wonder Woman, which opens on June 2nd, and here is the new trailer.
You will train her harder than any Amazon before her.
Never let your guard down. You expect the battle to be fair.
Until she is better than even you.
What is this place? Who are you?
It is our sacred duty to defend the world.
Right. Whoever you are in more danger than you think.
Be careful, Diana. If no one else will defend the world, then I must.
Now, I saw somebody complain on Twitter about that guitar riff that the Wonder Woman theme, which is really cool, and it worked like crazy in Batman versus Superman. And in the early trailers, it looked good. It is kind of jarring. Somebody said that it doesn't quite mesh with the rest of the trailer. And he's kind of right. The trailer is starting to look a lot more like Captain America than it is like Dawn of Justice, which is good because you need a different look. And I like the idea of making Wonder Woman a little more bright and optimistic than that heavy, dreary, desaturated look that even like Man of Steel had. So will that theme work in this new version? I don't know, but it does seem kind of tacked on at the end. I do find it also interesting that the Twitter ads are saying, get ready for the future of justice with the movie that takes place during World War I. I don't see where that's the future of justice. That's a weird tagline to put on the movie that's essentially a period piece. But the more I see of this movie, the more it looks like they're backing away from that overly dark and grim and dingy look that we got in both Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman. So that to me is a good thing. The next trailer I want to hit is Despicable Me 3. It opens on June 30th.
On behalf of your twin brother, Drew.
What? Twin brother?
Twin brother? Big Drew then?
What's the difference between me and you?
Who doesn't love this guy? Look at his face! Oh, he's so mad.
Basic Drew, villainy is in your blood.
You ready to continue the family tradition, you and me?
No, I left that life behind me.
Just one heist.
I was surprised at how much I loved the first Despicable Me. When the second Despicable Me came out, I was a little less into it because it felt forced. It certainly felt like a sequel, kind of the way Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, certainly feels like an excuse for a sequel that doesn't quite work together story-wise, and a lot of things are kind of crammed together. It felt a bit like an Ice Age movie where they're trying to give everybody a storyline, and the characters kind of had their growth and story in the first movie. So this looks like it's just going to be a little more whimsical and crazy, going to an adventure for Gru, which I'm all for. And I just hope that it doesn't get too annoying with the two versions of Gru, which might play off each other a little bit too much. And let the minions be wacky and crazy. Let Gru be grumbly. He's the Ren of the movies compared to Ren and Stimpy. So, yeah, we'll see. Despicable Me comes out this summer. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about T2 Train Spotting and the Belko Experiment. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the new films for the weekend. Well, this one's opening in limited release. It's actually getting a wider release in a lot of the places that are hearing this, and for my hometown, in a couple weeks. But I wanted to get this out of the way because it gets its New York and LA release, and that is T2 Train Spotting. 20 years after their adventures in crime and drugs, several Scottish heroin addicts reconnect.
Choose life. Choose Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and hope that someone, somewhere cares.
Missed you, mate.
I missed you too, Spud.
Choose looking up old flames, wishing you'd done it all differently.
Do you still take heroin?
No.
And choose watching history repeat itself. Choose your future.
Call the police.
What shall I say?
Just tell them we're dead.
And smother the pain with an unknown dose of an unknown drug made in somebody's kitchen. And then, take a deep breath.
I am a massive fan of the original Trainspotting. I thought that was one of the most unique, energetic, and brutally honest emotional movies you're ever going to see. And I'm also a huge fan of Danny Boyle, who did the original Trainspotting. And Danny Boyle, he's had some movies that I thought weren't his best, something like Trance, I think, was one that came out a couple years ago. But he's also done some fantastic movies, obviously. Slumdog Millionaire, a lot of people know about, but other movies like the original Trainspotting, for example, but he did Jobs a couple years ago, and that was an excellent movie. Sunshine, he did Millions. 28 Days Later, he is a brilliant director who continues to reinvent himself and is not shackled by any sort of genre. He did science fiction with Sunshine, he did horror with 28 Days Later, but then, you know, just biopics with Jobs and more of a whimsical, lighthearted drama, which is Slumdog Millionaire. I mean, he does a whole bunch of different things, and he's a very unique director. I don't think he's ever directly done a sequel before. And I never bought the need for a Trainspotting sequel, because the first movie is so unique that you don't need a sequel. It tells this very limited story about these guys in their 20s living a decadent life and running into all the problems that you're going to run into when you're addicted to heroin in Edinburgh in the 1990s. That movie's about people in their 20s. This one's about people in their 40s. And Danny Boyle's more than 20 years older than he was when he made that movie. So the style's a little different. You still have the energy of Danny Boyle, but it's the energy of a guy in his 40s. The characters are in their 40s. And I'm in my 40s, so I can relate to that. I know the difference in just your sitting around energy that you have in your 20s versus that which you have in your 40s. So the movie reflects that, not just in content and not just in character, but in tone of the story. There was this fast-paced, frenetic dance club feel to the original Trainspotting. It was also very surreal at times, you know, let itself be a bit drug trippy without being overtly drug trippy the way something from like the 60s, some psychedelic nonsense from the 60s. It was such a well-done movie. This one dials it back a bit. And I appreciated that. It was neat to see where these characters ended up 20 years later, everyone from Ewan McGregor's character, who was the main guy, to Kelly MacDonald's character, which was his lover in the first movie, to Johnny Lee Miller's character, to Ewan Bremmer's character. I found it personally interesting to watch because I wanted to see where these people went and how their emotions clashed when they finally came back together, especially when you throw Robert Carlyle's character in the mix. But it's not Trainspotting. I mean, it takes place in the same universe and has the same characters. But like I said, it's not about 20-something people taking heroin. It's about this group of people who've gotten past heroin. For whatever reason, they've either cleaned up relatively nicely, like Ewan Bremmer's character, or they've chose it for another addiction, like Ewan McGregor's character goes for the runner's high, whereas Johnny Lee Miller's character just switched over to cocaine. But you generally don't live into your 40s having taken heroin for 20 or 25 years. That will probably kill you pretty quickly. You don't have that longevity of a heroin addict's life. So all these people had of a reason and where they ended up. Robert Carlyle's character ended up in prison. And he's out for revenge now that he's escaped. I think it's a neat movie, but it only works if you've seen the original Trainspotting. If you've not seen the original Trainspotting, a lot of this isn't going to make sense, and it's just going to feel like this random hodgepodge of events. The other thing is this is going to be a hard sell for Americans in particular because of the Scottish accents. In fact, in my screening, I saw a couple people leave because, I mean, they're thick, thick Scottish accents. I mean, Ewan McGregor is the most understandable of everybody. I mean, you got Ewan Bremmer, you can barely understand what he's saying. And that's the way it was in the original movie. That's sort of part of the charm of one of these hardcore British based films, is they don't care that you don't understand it. Now, the difference is this one's getting a wide release and it's getting the big release, whereas the original was just this little neat little Miramax title that was just picked up from Scotland. So it's going to be a bit of a challenge, and it's not as good as Trainspotting, but nothing ever is. But it's a neat little movie, especially if you like the first film and you want to see where the characters end up. So I'm going to have to say that T2 Trainspotting kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Belko experiment. 80 workers are trapped in an office building in a social experiment that requires them to kill 30 of each other, or the experimenters will kill 60 of them in the end.
All employees, lend me your full attention. There are currently 80 of you in the building. In 2 hours, we want 30 of you dead. If 30 of you are not dead, we will end 60 of your lives ourselves.
We are not going to entertain the option of killing people.
I'm curious about this movie. It was not screened, but it comes from Blumhouse Tilt, or BH Tilt, which is an offshoot of Blumhouse. And Blumhouse, for those who don't know studios, I know a lot of people don't pay attention to what the studio is. Blumhouse, I think it has the distinction of being the most profitable studio in Hollywood. You'd think, oh, Disney or Warner Bros. Well, no, because, you know, even though the Avengers movies did very well, or Universal got a lot of money for Jurassic World, they put so much money into it. I mean, it's like, what did Avengers 2 cost? $250 million? That's a huge investment. And yeah, they got $1.5 billion off of it, but something like Blumhouse, they put in like $1 million or $2. Or like, look at like Get Out. Get Out's a great example. That's a movie that cost, I think, $4 million. It's made over $100 million by now. That's a huge return on investment. And if that were to be translated to like the $200-$250 million that studios like Disney sink into the Marvel films, those movies would be making tens of billions of dollars each, and they don't. So in terms of risk to return, Blumhouse is very successful. They're never going to be making $200 million smashes. They're happy to get $30-40 million for a movie that costs $3 or $4 million. That's, I think, what you're getting with the Belko experiment. It's very limited sets, but in the process, they don't spend a whole lot of money on marketing it, and they don't care what the critics have to say, because these movies do well whether or not the critics like them. But I'm curious about this movie. It's one of those that I am interested in. It looks, I love sort of people trapped in a room kind of movies. When they did Devil, that M. Night Shyamalan produced movie about the people stuck in an elevator, I thought that was a neat movie. I saw this described, and I forget whether it was like Dread Central that said this or Bloody Disgusting. They said it's like Battle Royale meets Office Space. Having worked in an office and understanding how soul crushing that can be, I'm curious to see where they go with this. So ultimately, I have to say it gets a preemptive suck, but I am kind of interested in seeing it.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Beauty and the Beast. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit or a lot about Beauty and the Beast. Let's get the trailer out of the way. In Disney's live-action remake of the classic animated film, a bookworm from a small village gives up her freedom to save her father from an enchanted beast living in seclusion.
I will escape, I promise.
Look, a girl.
Who said that?
Hello.
You can talk.
Hello, horse. It's all he ever does.
How lovely to make your acquaintance.
What happens when the last petal falls?
The Mastel remains a beast forever.
And we become antiques. What did you do to it?
Nothing.
Get out of here! Go!
I'm taking a little bit more time in this segment because I want to address some of what was said last week, which is the big news story that seems to be side-swiping Beauty and the Beast, is the issue of there being a gay character in it. And I finally got a chance to see the movie. I was speculating last week about it. But look, it's not like that big of a deal in the movie. It's pretty clear that LaFoe has a real man crush on Gaston. And honestly, I have to say, everyone's talking about the one scene that it's a gay scene. I have to be honest with you. There's like one little bit that I'm like, maybe that's what they're talking about. I guess that the scene that they're talking about is this one thing that happens and there's another character that is involved. But it is so minor and subtle, and it is actually played off as funny and silly. It's played off as a joke. And that's not to say that homosexuality is a joke. I mean, come on. It's 2017. This is something we can get over, I think. It's not that big of a deal. But again, like I said, I think the reason it's significant is because you've got countries like, I guess, in Russia and Malaysia where they're like going to boycott, like not allow the film to be shown because you're not allowed to show gay characters. And I've pointed out before, there's a list of other characters in Disney movies that could have been gay. We got to get over this, people. This is not that big of a deal. And like I said, it is being played off as funny and silly, and that's, of course, the first way you're going to see it. And it is the villain, or not really the villain, but the sidekick. You know, I think it would be interesting at some point if there were a character, and I don't think you've got to make a movie about a character being gay. It's just they can be in there. You know, maybe it'll be a good guy next time, and there's nothing wrong with that. Now, with that said, Josh Gad does gay it up quite a bit in this movie. It's very obvious that he is playing somebody who is attracted to Gaston. But it's already a lavish movie. I mean, when you look at this, I mean, so him being almost flamboyant at times, the movie itself is flamboyant. If you look at the set design and the costume design, I mean, we're talking a couple centuries ago in France. So that time was very showy, we'll say. I mean, you got the lavish gold. I mean, there's so much gold trim. You feel like you're in Trump's penthouse. I mean, there's these flowing dresses and these wigs and makeup and everything. And so it's somewhat lavish, which you kind of expect from Bill Condon because of that's the sort of flair he seems to put in a lot of his films. But what I find so fascinating about the controversy that's erupted from this is you've got somebody like Ian McKellen, who plays the voice of Cogsworth. Well, Ian McKellen's gay. He's been gay out of the closet gay for a long time. No, everyone's okay with having him act in their movies, but God forbid if he is who is, I guess he's okay to employ in the film, but not okay to have who he is sort of represented on screen. I mean, it's very elitist to treat it that way. And again, we're talking again about the same sort of complaints people had about the potential of two mommies, a lesbian couple in Finding Dory, which wasn't the case, but people were freaking out about it. And you're just like, you do realize that the person who does the voice for Dory is a lesbian. and she was a lesbian, a known lesbian when they made the first movie. So it's okay for her to be in the movie. It's okay to make money off of her and have your kids see her films. But oh, God forbid if there's a character that's in the movie that's like people that exist in real life. Ultimately, it is sort of silly because this is a story about captivity, bestiality, and attempted murder. But not a peep about that. But you throw in a gay henchman and suddenly, you know, the world is over. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the film itself. Beauty and the Beast was my favorite cell animated Disney movie that came kind of from that second renaissance, from The Little Mermaid on through Pocahontas-ish. I think it was on its downslope with Pocahontas, but there was this brilliant bubble of Disney movies where you had The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Lion King, and Beauty and the Beast was my favorite, and I loved The Little Mermaid, and I loved Aladdin, but Beauty and the Beast was clearly my favorite, and so it had a lot to live up to. So know that going in. It's very, very hard to remake something that you love because it's not going to be the original. Of all of these Disney movies that so far have come out that are live action updates or live action photorealistic CGI updates, this one's the closest to the original. Like the Jungle Book is very different. The Jungle Book it tells a story about Shere Khan trying to track down Mowgli, but it's done in a very different way. And it doesn't have all of the scenes. It's not like there's a scene for scene shoot that this movie took. Same thing with Pete's Dragon, which was completely updated. Now you have it closer with Cinderella, because Cinderella was, of course, the very typical Cinderella story, but it was more of a Cinderella story than it was a direct shot-for-shot remake of the Cinderella movie from the 50s. This one, in many ways, there's almost shot-for-shot scenes in this film, which isn't a bad thing, because you are just realizing it, again, you're realizing it in live action. It does have a bit more in it. There's a couple more scenes. There's a couple extra stuff that's thrown in that may have been in the original script of the 1991 version. But this one gives a little bit more, a couple more scenes of her father, a couple more of the beast and some background and that sort of thing. And there's also a couple songs in there that are not from the original. And you don't have Howard Ashman's lyrics. I mean, he passed away in the middle of the production of Aladdin. And losing him, the songs stand out. The songs that are not Howard Ashman originals stand out in this movie because they're just not as good. It's because Howard Ashman was such a genius with his words. And it's sort of like when you see and this is a bad comparison, but I'm going to say when they did that Cat in the Hat movie, when they directly quoted from Dr. Seuss, it had the love and charm and wonder and wit and witticism of Dr. Seuss. When it was a screenwriter trying to emulate Dr. Seuss, it seemed like it wasn't as good, and it wasn't. And even though this is way better than Cat in the Hat, but it is an almost shot for shot remake, and it's very elaborate and lavish. And sometimes it's borderlines on gaudy, but like I said earlier, it's sort of that, you know, what, 18th century French look, and that's what you get. Now, with that said, it's a perfectly charming, wonderful movie. It works. It recaptures the magic of the original. It did just kind of make me want to watch the original, though. That's the thing I really wanted to see. And that's because it's so ingrained as one of my favorites. And in a sense, it does kind of feel unnecessary. And there's something about the CGI characters that I'm watching, and I'm like, you know, you could have done these characters 30 years ago with stop motion animation and Jim Henson's Creature Shop. You could have essentially made this movie without the computers, because it would lend itself to some of this. I mean, obviously some of those landscapes would be different, but there's almost nothing in this movie that couldn't have been realized with puppetry, which would have been an interesting thing to see. Would have been very expensive, but then again, this was very expensive. And then there's Emma Watson. You know, look, I think Emma Watson is a perfectly fine actress, but I don't think she's really let herself be exposed as an actress. Everything I've ever seen her in, she's very prim and proper, or at least reserved. You know, even in something like The Bling Ring, where she kind of played an idiot, and she was good in that movie, but she was kind of an idiot who had her stuff together, so to speak. And even there was this movie, Colonia, that I saw, I think it was last year, and I reviewed on the show, about her and Daniel Brühl, and they were like in, you know, like Colombia or somewhere in South America during a revolution, and he gets sent to, like a prison camp. And that was a very bearing and open performance, but even then it was Emma Watson being prim and proper. I don't think she's ever completely given herself into the acting. And you're not going to get this here because that's really not what the story is. But ultimately, the Beauty and the Beast, this remake is, it's charming and beautiful and it's Disney magic. It's just not the original. But I'm still going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Atomica, the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup.
Shake that.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. This is Kevin Carr, your intrepid host, heading through the movie reviews. Let's continue with one that falls into the sci-fi genre, and that is Atomica. A woman goes to a remote nuclear waste facility for repairs, only to discover a deranged technician and a missing nuclear physicist hiding a dangerous secret.
Gibson Desert North is the largest nuclear waste repository in the Southern Hemisphere.
Who are you?
I'm here to get you back online.
I saw a man in the desert, and he's hurt, and he needs our help. He doesn't seem to remember anything. Does he seem dangerous to you?
Well, things aren't always what they seem.
This is produced by, well, Epic Pictures released it and produced it. They're the ones who did movies like Turbo Kid, and Epic Pictures has some good stuff out there. This one is also produced by Sci-Fi Pictures, SYFY, which is the same as the Sci-Fi Network. I'm assuming that it's an offshoot of the Sci-Fi Network, which used to be the Sci-Fi Channel, and now it's just Sci-Fi, which they rebranded, and they were doing wrestling at one point. But I think they're back to trying to do bona fide science fiction again. But this is not a TV movie. It's actually coming out in theaters this week, and it hits VOD on Tuesday. And this is what's nice about a movie like this. It's not going to be in a lot of theaters. It's not. There's a lot of theaters that aren't just going to carry it because it's a smaller film and they're going to put Beauty and the Beast on 15 screens. This is a movie that it's better than the series of sci-fi movies that we were getting in the Sharknado realm. There was a period of time where if it was a sci-fi movie, it was either from The Asylum, and Asylum has some fun garbage, and Sharknado was fun, but everything doesn't have to be Sharknado or strive for its own absurdity like that. Atomica is a smaller film, and it's only got four, because there's another character that flies her out, a pilot who flies her out there. But other than that, it's got a basic cast of three people, and they're at this nuclear waste facility in the future after the whole place is radioactive, and she has to go in there and, you know, try and get the thing back up and running because she doesn't know, they've lost contact with them. And there's clearly something wrong here. And it's an interesting, it's like a spaceship movie. You know, you've seen these movies where it all takes place on a spaceship and there's like a handful of people. And I've always liked those movies. And the way this works is you feel like you're on another planet because they're in a wasteland. They're in a nuclear wasteland that has been radioactive, so nobody can go there. And, you know, so there's a certain danger there. And even though it still takes place on Earth, it might as well be on another planet. It's a neat movie. Now, I mean, it has some predictability, and it's not a brilliant film. It's not one of the greatest science fiction film. But for a limited budget, a smaller little film, it actually has some tense moments, and it has two great performances. The female lead, she's fine, but it's Dominic Monaghan, who most people will recognize from Lost, but he was also in The Lord of the Rings as one of the Hobbit pair that was asking for a second breakfast and 11z's to eat, which I am a huge fan of, by the way. Then there's also Tom Sizemore, who he's blown hot and cold in his career, but he actually plays a nice sort of understated guy in this. He comes in later in the movie, but this isn't a bad little throwaway film for sort of like these people stuck in a harrowing situation where they're sort of trapped by radiation, and there's no way to get out, and there's no way to effectively communicate with the outside world. So, you know, like I said, for a Saturday afternoon watch, you know, if you can catch it in your theaters, check it out. You can get it on demand next week on Tuesday. I'm going to have to say that Atomica kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. What did I say last week? I said that Kong was going to make $45 million. I was right in the sense that Kong overperformed. A lot of people were like saying low 40s, maybe even high 30s. It made $61 million. And I think what really propelled that was it just had great reviews, and it's a fun movie and it's an exciting movie. And that's significant mainly because it's coming off of a weekend with Logan, and Logan the weekend before was what, 80 some million, 88 million or something for Logan. And then ended up making 38 million this week. But usually you would have expected them both to feed from the same audience. But boy, 61 million for Kong, and then the 1-2 punch of Logan in its second weekend getting 38 million. This is a big testosterone double bill weekend. And even then, Get Out made almost 21 million last weekend, cracked the 100 million barrier. It's at 110 million going into the week. So it's going to be at 120 some million going into the weekend. Makes it the first movie wrote and directed by a black guy that reaches over 100 million in his debut for directing. So, you know, good for Jordan Peele. Kong was the king, and others did well. And Ottoman Lieutenant didn't do terribly well. Only made 150,000, but, you know, I didn't think it was going to become a huge movie. But Kong gets one weekend as king because Beauty and the Beast is going to win this time around. The big discussion is how much is it going to do? I mean, people are talking $250 million globally, which is, I think, possible, especially if they're rolling it out day and date in all these countries. And in the right countries, but just talking domestically, I've heard estimations over 150 million. I don't know if it's going to do that. I mean, it's going to do well, but I'm going to conservatively say 125 million for Beauty and the Beast, mainly because that's still great for a March movie. I mean, what's the record in March? 166 million, I think, was what Batman versus Superman did last year. And that's a huge number. But in Hunger Games, yeah, 150 million. I think one of the things that's going to lower the numbers a bit is there's so many kids that are going to be seeing Beauty and the Beast. Their tickets are cheaper. So you're going to actually see a suppression. Your ticket numbers will be really good, but they're going to be slightly lower than you would expect for something like even the Hunger Games and certainly Batman versus Superman, which drew kids to the movie, but not, I think, in the family audience atmosphere that you're gonna don't go see Beauty and the Beast on a Saturday matinee. You're crazy if you do, because it's gonna be packed with people, kids. But yeah, 125 million at least is what Beauty and the Beast is gonna do. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The one I want to spotlight this week is Allied on Blu-ray. I was not able to review this back in November when it came out. It was leading up to Thanksgiving weekend because they didn't screen it for us. And by the time I got a screener for award consideration, it was past its review window. But it came out a couple weeks on Blu-ray, so let's take a look at it. Brad Pitt stars in this World War II romance about an Allied agent who is informed his wife might be a German spy.
We found each other. Come with me to London. Come with me and be my wife.
There's no easy way to say what we're about to say.
We suspect your wife is a German spy.
It's insane.
If you are right, all this will be forgotten.
But if she is,
you will execute her with your own hand, and if you do not comply, you'll be hanged.
This is also directed by Robert Zemeckis, and I find it interesting. His career is very interesting, Robert Zemeckis, because he started out doing movies like the Back to the Future films. Then he did Forrest Gump, and he won an Academy Award. And then he did some other big high-profile stuff like Castaway. And then he sort of stumbled. He got wrapped up in the motion capture animation stuff with like the Christmas Carol and Mars Needs Moms, but he also couldn't get away from gimmick movies. And his last big gimmick movie was The Walk, which is the one about Joseph Gordon-Levitt walking across the Twin Towers on a tightrope with a terrible French accent. But this is not a gimmick movie. It's a straightforward film, and it's kind of nice to see him return to that. The movie itself's okay. It's trying to be this epic romance, but it's struggling whether it's a romance or whether it's a war film. I mean, it's well made. I mean, it's better than the Brad Pitt movies that he did with his, you know, Angelina Jolie, like By the Sea, which was awful. But, you know, overall, I mean, for sort of like a, you know, again, kind of like that Weekend Video stuff. If you haven't seen it and you like these actors, it's not bad. It's worth a watch. So I'm going to, you know, revise and say that, you know, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
There's a couple other movies that are out on DVD and Blu-ray this week that are new this week. Of course, there's Passengers with Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence, which is terrible. Looks great, but it's really terrible. Mainly because, I mean, if you want to, Beauty and the Beast is about captivity, but this one's really about captivity as well. And there's problems with the character that got in the way of you actually enjoying the movie. And then there's, from the awards section, you've got Fences with Denzel Washington and Viola Davis, who won an Oscar for it. That's out on DVD and Blu-ray, along with Elle, which was, of course, Isabelle Huppert as a woman who suffers sexual assault and then has to kind of work it through her life. That one is out on DVD and Blu-ray if you want to check out her performance. It's a very good performance. There's a couple other ones. The Love Witch I talked about. Red Dawn is getting the original Red Dawn is getting a release on Blu-ray. And then Ghost in the Shell, the original anime film, is out as well. That is it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Chips, Life, and Power Rangers. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.